we're here now. We just want to get a 2 or 3 minutes each, maybe three tops from each of the panelists, just setting out where they're coming from on this, and then we'll open up for questions and we'll have a little chat then. Is that with you, Al? Give me your pitch.
My pitch. The evening. First of all, thank you very much for having me here. It's always a pleasure to be in Wales, and an even greater pleasure when there's a room full of people like this. Where my organisation comes from is population growth. At the moment, our population is growing at the fastest for nearly 100 years. That population growth is largely driven by migration. At 265,000 net a year migration, we are looking at a growth of 500,000 people a year. That's migrants and their children in the future. Now that reflects a scale that is simply not manageable. It's not sensible. I'm an immigrant. I'm a first generation immigrant. There are a lot of immigrants here, I'm sure. There's no question of saying no immigration. That would be batty. What we want is sensible levels of immigration. You asked about Wales and migration into Wales. Looking at the latest figures that I found, over a 3-year period, there were 50,000 net, which doesn't sound a lot, except if you go back further, the average annual increase, net migration, was something like 1,000 to 3,000. That, I think, is an important factor in determining how people are going to vote or what they think about migration. Looking at the UK, about half our migration is now from the EU. It was the EU that was, and still is, the uncontrollable bit of the equation. What we now have is an opportunity to control that. We have suggested a system of extending our existing system that applies to non-EU migrants, have a work permit system. It's perfectly simple, straightforward. We focus on the skills that we need and to a very large extent keep out those who do not have the skills. At the moment, there is something like 70% of EU nationals coming here come to work. Of that 70%, 80% go into low-skill, low-paid work. That is not something that we believe is necessary. We can have visa-free access for visitors, for students, for business visitors, for the self-sufficient, for people coming here for genuine marriage. No question of stopping people like that coming here. Youth mobility schemes to allow young people to move about freely, I see no problem with that. We can have special schemes for key workers where there are gaps, and indeed we can have a shortage of occupation list as we have at the moment. Lots more that I can say, but what we'll finish by saying, bear in mind that 17 out of the 22 areas that voted in the referendum voted to come out. Let's not forget that. Let's get on with it, frankly. We are where we are, and in the interests of our country, let's all unite in working for a deal that works for us.
Thank you very much. Noreen, give me your views on it.
Thank you. I work in public services, but actually I'm here tonight more in a personal role or in personal capacity rather than in a professional role. Because I'm a European citizen. I was born and I grew up in France. My mum's from Singapore, so I grew up bilingual, speaking English at home and French in school. And I grew up with elements of British culture in my upbringing. So I moved to Wales when I was 17 years ago, to do the research for my degree in university in Aberystwyth, and I stayed on to work. Now I'm a freelance consultant working in public services, primarily in Wales. So I am an immigrant, and I kind of like to joke that I'm not one of the ones that's stealing a job because I made my own. But you know, based on what we've heard so far, immigrants seem to be mainly perceived as, you know, refugees, people from the Eastern Bloc, and clearly they're immigrants like myself who are much more acceptable than others. I was asked earlier, you know, why have you got a British passport? Did you get one? And as a European citizen, I've never had the need to relinquish my nationality and my French passport and switch. Although I did have the thought recently that actually I'm not that bothered about a British passport. It might come to that, I might have to get round to it. But if there had been a Welsh passport on offer, I would definitely have switched, because actually this is home, this is where my life is now, this is where I belong. And on a personal level, we don't really know what's going to happen yet, either in terms of what's, you know, are we going to close the borders to any new immigrants or any new migrations, and how, what's going to be the impact on people who are already here in the UK, and what happens to UK citizens who are in the rest of Europe. Everything's really up in the air at the moment. But personally, I don't want to be sent to France because home is here. I thought it was really interesting, actually, that immigration is a much higher concern than the economic situation and the economic impact of Brexit. And to me, it doesn't make sense because it goes hand in hand. And saying, oh, well, we want all the great trade deals, but we don't want the movement of people, feels like trying to get your cake and eat it too, and it just seems completely unreasonable. But my concern is more about the economic impact on everyday life, because if you add the privatization of the NHS and talking about reducing corporate tax and turning Britain into a tax haven, I'm really worried, and this is a bit more with my work hat on, is for the public services and the infrastructures that we need to support the people who are vulnerable amongst us. And I don't mean just the people who are unemployed and benefits. This means all of us. If we get ill, if we have an accident in our old age, we need our infrastructure and our services. So saying we don't have enough for us, so we can't allow anybody else to come along, I think it's a misplaced argument, and I think it's fear-mongering. What we really need to look at is an economic system, and I know this is out of the scope of tonight, but the issue is the economic system that's not capable of being sustainable. So I'm working towards, you know, equality, more social justice, a more fair and inclusive society. And one of the questions I'd like to ask is, don't we need to think about how we measure our worth as human beings and the contributions we make to our communities and to our neighborhoods, and who gets to decide how much somebody contributes to not just the economy, but society as a whole? And how is it fair if we say one person is okay and one person isn't okay? Who makes that decision? But my last thought is that actually, as a devolved nation, Wales in itself, it seems like we're going to have very little say. Whatever we think tonight, and whether we come to an agreement or not, or whether it's just an interesting airing of opinions, we're not going to have a massive influence on what's happening in the UK. But I think it would be a real shame if we close our borders, because we will, as a nation, lose significantly in terms of cultural and human terms. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Plenty of points already raised here. Brilliant. Vanessa, you're up.
Thank you. So I guess I'm here to give a public service perspective on this issue. The Welsh NHS Confederation is a membership organisation, and as Arwen said, we represent the 7 health boards and the 3 trusts in Wales. And we do that by trying to present a single authentic voice for the NHS leadership. And in surveying our members last year about the challenges facing the NHS, it was workforce that came out as the most significant issue for all of our members. Recruitment and retention across organisations is a significant issue. There are about 130,000 people working in the health sector in Wales, and 86,500 of those are directly employed by the NHS. And they cost, in terms of the pay bill, about £3.3 billion a year. So the NHS workforce is a really significant factor to our economy, and a really significant factor in terms of delivering those services. And we are facing staff shortages across a wide range of professional roles, both doctors in hospitals and GPs, nurses, some therapies and also some specialties, things like paediatrics and also ophthalmology. And these shortages are really having an impact both on performance issues, service performance, but also on financial performance of organisations. Not to mention the attempts that we're trying to make to reconfigure services to meet the demands that we know are coming through the ageing demographic. So across the UK, Wales is similar in being reliant on EU workers to help address some of those challenges. And so we believe the priority in terms of the sort of post-Brexit deal should be to ensure that we can continue to recruit people from the EU into the health and social care sector, while at the same time trying to increase the domestic supply for our workforce. We're actually part of the Cavendish Coalition, which is 31 health and social care organisations across the UK that are looking at the implications of coming out of the EU. And we are working with them to consider what the best potential outcome could be in terms of trying to protect the workforce issues that we have. In Wales, in September 2016, we had around 1,300 people working for the NHS from the EU. And while that figure is quite a small percentage of the overall number employed, the interesting thing to consider is that's a 15% increase on the same point last year. And also within that figure, it's interesting to note that doctors in particular are 8% of doctors are coming from the EU. We've also seen figures from the Royal College of Nursing in Wales, which shows that nearly 9% of nurses in 2013-14 were from the EU, and that was an increase from 2% in 2010-11. So those figures suggest that we're becoming more reliant on EU workers, and that's maybe particularly so in the last year or so, because we have got these significant staff shortages. So there's a decision to try and grow our workforce domestically across the UK, and that's welcome. But the other issue to note is that workforce planning isn't an exact science, and actually it can be very difficult to predict now how many of particular professions we're going to need over the medium term. And shortages in staff groups can occur within 2 to 3 years, but can actually take something like 10 or 15 years to resolve through the domestic workforce. And that's why we think we need this flexibility, not just within the EU, but beyond the EU too, to be able to manage our workforce by being able to recruit and retain people from the EU.
And finally, Marley, give us your views on it.
Thank you very much. My name's Marley. I work for IPPR, one of the leading progressive think tanks in the UK. And we've been doing lots of work on this issue. I guess I'd start by saying just that the vote to leave the EU was in many ways a vote of no confidence in our current immigration policy. Obviously, everyone who voted to leave, they didn't all vote because of immigration, but lots of people did, and lots of people who voted remain were also concerned about immigration. So it's clear that immigration is a major concern, not just in Wales, as Roger was showing, but also in the rest of the country as well. And that means that leaving the EU does require a serious rethink of how our immigration policy works, not just for EU migration, but across the board. But a serious rethink really means that we need to take seriously the various considerations about how to develop a new immigration policy. Now, we've been doing some work about what those important considerations should be. I just want to point to a few of them in the next couple of minutes. One, of course, are the impacts of any change to the current rules on the labour market across the UK. And we know from very detailed analysis of the labour force survey that EU nationals make up a disproportionate amount of the workforce in key sectors of our economy, particularly sectors such as hospitality, food processing, distribution and logistics, and construction and agriculture. In each of these sectors, EU migrants play a key role, and simply restricting low-skilled migration in those sectors would have a really dire effect on employers in those sectors. So any new system that needs to be introduced needs to very carefully manage
how to ensure that those employers are able to access the labour that they need. Second, we'd say that another key aspect to any new immigration policy is how it can be implemented. And of course, many ideas have been proposed about how to introduce a new immigration policy. Some of those ideas are probably not feasible. Some of those ideas are feasible, but would require extensive and impossible to manage resources. So again, managing how to enforce a new immigration policy, how to do it in a sensible way within a relatively short time period is a crucial consideration. The third point which I'd make is the negotiability of any new deal. Now, there's one school of thought on this which says that we don't really need to negotiate with the EU on immigration. We can simply just go to the EU, propose our immigration policy, and then we can just get back whatever we want in terms of good trade in goods and services. So, in a sense, immigration becomes a fixed point in the negotiations. We make our decision and then simply get whatever we can get when it comes to the rest of our trade needs. Now, I think that would be a mistake for the government to make going ahead into the negotiations, for the simple reason that we know that immigration is so bound up with all the other aspects of trade and goods and services. So to get the best deal for the UK, we think it's essential to negotiate on immigration specifically in the forthcoming discussions with the EU after Article 50's and vote. And that's going to require a compromise on both sides. And we've discussed various options about how a compromise can work. The final point I would make is that as part of any new deal, any new policy on immigration, we think it's particularly important, and this reflects the question that was asked for this debate, to think about how we can give the nations of the UK and indeed the regions of England more control and more of a say over how immigration policy works in their area. Now that means that we can think about ways for the individual nations and individual regions to feed into or to even decide how many immigrants or what kinds of rules that could work for labour migration in those areas. Now, of course, that doesn't mean borders going up across the UK, but what it does mean is you can have different rules for managing labour migration and enforce that through the labour market by, for instance, saying employers in some areas can make rules that are different in other areas, and that can be enforced through the labour market, as indeed the immigration system for non-EU migrants is generally enforced at the moment. So I think, you know, the key point for us is that the leaving the EU, you know, it creates major challenges, but it also creates opportunities for how to think about a new immigration policy and opens up new avenues to create an immigration policy that can have full public confidence and can work for every different part of the country. And when we know there are different concerns and different needs in different nations and different regions of the UK.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. I just want to kick off with a couple of questions, and I'll start with Marley then. The point that you're making about the nations and regions having their own sort of bespoke deals, and it's something that we know Nicola Sturgeon's quite keen on, Carwyn Jones has said, doesn't show if it's practical. You mentioned there you could enforce it through the labour market. Give me a detail, how would that work then?
Well, so obviously currently with the current system for skilled workers, the tier two system for non-EU migrants, you are able to work in the UK because you get a certificate of sponsorship from your employer, and that's how you're able to work. So your employer signs off and gives you the right to work in the UK. So all you could do is, in a sense, is tag that to a particular region. So, for instance, in Wales, for instance, the Welsh administration could decide its own rules for how to manage labour migration, and could then be enforced through the Home Office. So employers in Wales would have their own sets of rules to abide by when they want to hire migrants. So for instance, a migrant that wants to come to work in Wales would have to abide by some rules. If they wanted then to go and work in other parts of the country, they would then have to apply to the Home Office again for using a separate scheme. So it would differ across the country depending on the rules that were in force in each nation and region.
And what's to stop somebody from coming to Wales if say Wales has a more generous, for example, a more generous entrance sort of quota than the rest of the UK? What's to stop you coming from Wales and then crossing over the border, going down the M4.
Yeah. Well, it would be illegal to work in that other area, and the employer would be breaking the law if they were to hire that worker. So there would be a significant fine or potentially a criminal charge for that employer, and also you would no longer be able to renew your visa the next time. So there would be a heavy incentive for employers and for migrants not to do that and not to abuse the system.
Okay. I'm going to keep an eye out if there are hands going up in the audience. But I was going to come to you. I mean, what do you make of that, Alp, as an idea?
Well, Marley knows that I don't think very much of it. Firstly, it's going to be an absolutely bureaucratic nightmare. You can't have bits of the United Kingdom deciding on what its migration policy is going to be. It's going to lead to utter chaos. And in fact, in the end, rather than lowering migration, it will increase it. What I particularly
Why do you think it would increase migration if that happened?
Because if you've got individual bits of the United Kingdom deciding what they need at any given time, the likelihood is that every single bit of the whole setup is going to be going for more people than would actually happen were it controlled centrally. That happens in places like Canada, where they found that people come, but then you have the freedom to move about. Otherwise, we're back to the Soviet Union, for goodness sake, that people live and work in a particular area. We're not that sort of country. It's complexity and bureaucracy that will make it very, very inefficient and almost unenforceable, I would guess.
You mentioned in your I like pitch that you're saying that there'd be work permits focusing on the skills that are needed. Who decides which skills are needed, and how do you make sure they can be nimble enough to react then to what's needed?
Because we already have the system. We already have the system that applies to non-EU nationals, and all we're proposing is that it's extended. There may be areas where we could vary it for particular countries, but by and large, it's a system that's been around for a lot. It's been around since I was an immigration officer in the 70s, and it works.
What do you make of that? What do you make of it, Noreen? That idea?
I guess if we have a structure in place, it would be simpler to extend its scope to the people it covers than to create something from scratch. But I'm not sure it's answering the right questions.
What do you mean? Go on, you're holding back. Go on, say it. Just say it.
I just don't think it's fair. I don't think we're asking the right questions, and I don't think we're measuring the right things.
What questions should we be asking? I mean, when people come into the country, you mean?
When people are coming into the country or are in the country, the huge focus is on, I guess, it's a natural human thing, but the huge focus is on the people who are coming in saying, okay, what do you have offer to us? You know, what do you have to offer to the country you're coming to? And the main question is primarily on economic level. And so hence saying, well, we'd want to turn refugees away, we want to turn children away, because actually they're a drain on our society and they're not going to add any value to us, because we're thinking in terms of economic monetary value, and we're not looking at the wider picture of social value and how people can make a contribution to wider their communities, their environment.
Alp is shaking his head at that, and I'll come to you in a minute. I want to talk to Vanessa first of all, and then we will come back. Just because on the EU non-EU point that Alp was raising there, that you were saying, what is it, 35%. Staff from outside the UK and 8% of those EU, the rest are non-EU. So would further curbs on EU migrants be a big problem for you if you already have to work within those constraints of non-EU migration?
I think a couple of things really, that we've seen changes to non-EU migration also have making it potentially a more difficult, and anything that impacts on our ability to tackle the shortages whether it's in non-EU or EU, can have quite a dramatic impact. So a small change in the number of staff that we have impacts both service and finance. So although 8% might not sound that much in terms of doctors, for example, we're talking about here, even just those small numbers can have a difference, because we need to have all three of those components, domestic market, the non-EU market, and the EU market working together.
But and that's a failure, I guess, of domestic government, isn't it? Westminster, Welsh government, not preparing enough of the staff that you need to run the NHS.
I think in recent years, if you look at what's happened since 2008 with constraints on public finances, some decisions have been taken that have led us to some of the shortages that we're now seeing. But I go back to the point that I made in my introductory comments, that workforce planning is not an exact science, and some of these shortages can occur within a 2 to 3 year period, but can take years to recover from. And so while the government, both in Wales and more widely in the rest of the UK, is recognising the need to train more professionals, that process takes time. It takes a long time to train a doctor, to train a consultant ophthalmologist, for example. And so we have to recognise that in the meantime, while we're trying to do that, we need to tackle the shortages by looking elsewhere, to look to the EU, look to non-EU, but even in the future, there will always be a need for us to look outside our own labour market.
Okay. Alp, go on, come back in.
Well, just on that point, I alluded to it in what I said, that where there are areas of key workers needed, absolutely no reason why we shouldn't do what we're doing at the moment. Nurses are on the shortage of occupation list. So I have no problem with that, but I think a pertinent point is what Vanessa said about the reasons why we have a shortage. If you look at the percentage of overseas doctors in a country like Germany, for example, or France, considerably less than ours. Similarly with nurses. What we should be doing is now thinking ahead and beginning to train more nurses, more doctors, more ophthalmologists. Just going back to what Noreen said as well, though, can we please separate refugees, asylees from the sort of migration and migrants that we're talking about? No one is questioning the fact that those who need refuge from persecution, from all sorts of areas that we've signed up to, I have no problem with that, and they're not an immigration issue.
But the public, the poll we saw from Roger suggests that the public think they are.
Some do. By and large, students, they are migrants simply because the United Nations says that's what they are. Anyone who moves to live for longer than a year in a country is considered a migrant and should be included in the overall figures. We can separate them, but people will still lump them together in the end.
Yeah, of course.
Just make a point on Alp's sort of argument that we can just simply take the current system for non-EU migrants and just put all the EU migrants into it. I think that's superficially appealing because it sounds simple. However, the problem is that the current system for non-EU migrants is completely predicated on freedom of movement, because employers currently have a recourse to be able to access the whole EU labour market with relative ease. If that is suddenly taken away and suddenly we have an EU migration system that's the same as non-EU migration, then that raises a whole new range of major problems for employers, particularly those in low-skilled sectors, because they'll have no recourse to access labour from outside of the UK. And we're talking about a major change here. So Alp mentioned briefly this 80% figure. I mean, so it is true that if you were to take the current tier two system and just apply EU migrants into it, because the skills thresholds and the income thresholds are quite high, i.e., you know, basically in April this year, the income threshold for being a skilled worker will be £30,000 or more, i.e., a very high threshold. That means that huge numbers of EU migrants are not going to be eligible for such a system. And that means that those sectors that rely on low-skilled workers are just going to have no recourse to labour from outside of the UK, and that's going to be hugely damaging for those sectors. So I think we need to think really seriously about our new system and about how to manage those impacts before rushing ahead and saying, let's just go for the most simple one off the shelf.
Ah, we have got a question in the corner there. If you just bear me 1 second while we get a microphone to you.
Whilst we're waiting, 80,000 people came in last year who had no job. They came here on spec. They came from the EU. We've also had, over the last 3 years, 50,000 a year coming in from Romania and Bulgaria. I would argue that our economy does not need these people.
And it's a point we'll raise just as soon as we've had this question, unless that's your question.
not quite, but very close. Philip Owen, Volga Trader, Trade and Investment Consultancy. There are 1.6 million people unemployed in the UK itself, and they don't move from Maesteg to Bridgend to get a job. They don't move from Blaenau Gwent to Cardiff to get a job, far less to London. So isn't a large part of this issue about low-skilled immigration a failure in the benefit system? That people do get trapped in a particular location and they're unable to contribute to the sort of elasticity of the labour market in places like London. So we've got 1.6 million people who aren't working while we still are accepting, as you've seen, potentially immigrants now from Bulgaria and Romania.
I guess, yeah, the point out that, you know, you have these people out of work, but they won't travel very far, whereas maybe an EU migrant would be more willing to move to get the job, you mean?
Yeah, but basically, it isn't part of the issue, nothing to do with the source of immigrants, but our own arrangements here. I mean, our employers are basically not offering enough to get people off benefits in the first place.
But do you think that inability or unwillingness of people to travel from Maesteg to Bridgend, from Blaenau Gwent to Cardiff, is that a failure on the behalf of the people themselves, do you think? Or is it, do you think, an issue of there's no transport, they can't go there, you know?
There's no transport, they can't go. By the time you've taken two or three bus stages, it's getting to be an arduous journey.
So you don't think they're idle?
They're not idle, they're trapped. Yeah.
What about that point, Alf? That, you know, that you can't get to where the jobs are?
Well, there are 1.6 million unemployed. There are also 1.1 million who are part-time workers. There's a lot of them. Not everyone would be prepared to move, of course, and they're not able to. On the other hand, I think if we paid them a little more as employers, that might encourage them to do it. If working conditions in certain sectors was a bit better, perhaps that might persuade people. If we encouraged young people to go into the building trade, that too might longer term help. And at the moment, we don't do any of those things. And the fact is that if you want a Romanian, a Bulgarian, a Lithuanian who is here, just arrived, desperate for a job, who's prepared to work for less money and all the hours that God has sent, then of course they're going to be attractive. That's the sort of area that we need to address. One last thing. In fact, those from the EU who have been coming here in huge numbers for the lower end of the pay scale, as it were, that's been happening relatively recently. What did we do before that, for goodness sake?
Noreen, you're the person, I guess, who has come here. You haven't sold any jobs, you made your own jobs, but is it that willingness to travel that you think has meant that EU migrants have been able to fill the jobs that we're seeing that aren't being filled?
I'm not sure I'm best qualified to answer that because I'm probably not. I'm not an economic migrant as such because I didn't come here to work because there wasn't work at home.
Okay.
I was here in university and I liked it here and I applied for a job and I got it, so I stayed. And eventually from job to job, I went freelance. But I didn't move here out of desperation because there was nothing for me where I was.
because Aberystwyth is lovely. We all get no two ways about that. Bess, what do you think about that point, that people aren't willing maybe to move about enough?
I guess in terms of looking at it from an NHS perspective, that we have certain staff shortages, particularly in rural areas, for example, and that's partly to do with the way in which job roles are available there. It's to do with the makeup of the rest of the workforce and the teams within the NHS, making it attractive for professionals to come and work in those teams if perhaps there isn't a university, the research function, those sorts of issues. So it's more to do with what the job offer is, and whether or not for skilled workers the package is something that's attractive. And then that's also looking at whether or not there are part-time roles available, for example. So looking at, if we're looking at GPs, some of the issues there are about whether or not the hours are amenable. It's all those sorts of issues that actually drive whether or not people want to take those roles.
Okay. Gentleman, third row there. Oh, you've already got the microphone. Fine.
Yes. Wyn Crompton from Cydweithio. I just want to throw in a very high-level comment here. All of this discussion has really been about the current status quo, where we are and where we're going in the short term. The forecasts at the moment are that in the next 20 years, 35% of jobs can be lost. And I just went through automation, if you talk about call center jobs, bots, and so on. And I just see that aspect missing completely from this debate at the minute.
Okay. Robots are going to steal all our jobs. Marley.
Well, I mean, if it does get to a situation where there are serious barriers to accessing EU labour after Brexit, then there will be a choice for employers about how to manage that, and one of the options will be to speed up automation, because I think that's one of the main options. The other main option is to try to use the UK workforce better, to try to, I don't know, hire students or unemployed or retired people. There are limited options for companies, and so it is possible that Brexit and restrictions on EU migration could actually speed up the automation process, as employers have no other option but to change their labour model, to change the model of how they work. So I mean, that's a possibility, but it's hard to say for sure at the moment what employers are going to do. And I think it will depend on the different sectors. So perhaps in agriculture we'll see more of that, but in other sectors, for instance, domestic personnel and cleaning, it might be harder to automate. So I think it depends on the sector.
Elon Musk, didn't he? The Silicon Valley technology giant said today he backs a basic income because of addressing the problems that we're all going to be out of work because of robots. But that's a different matter altogether.
Could I comment on that? There are jobs that robots can't do. They can't care for other people.
Yet. We're told.
I would argue the robots will not be... So a robot can maybe wash somebody, feed somebody, change bed sheets, but they can't provide connection and love. And I think that's the part of the part that can't be automated, and that's part of our core economy, is the connections between us, and it's the support networks, it's the grandparents looking after the grandchildren, it's the neighbours caring for each other that we'll still need. It's that core element, that core economy, and without which the monetary economy wouldn't exist.
We're
so I think there's
going to
be a reshift.
Yeah. It's an interesting
this
one,
subject,
but
so
maybe
I think
for
there's
another
going
to
be a reshift in what's
important. But you wanted to come in on it, Lisa.
I was just going to talk about the fact that digital technology and automation is something, obviously, that is going to be key to the NHS in the future, and is already part of solutions in terms of trying to drive greater productivity and efficiency, but also technological advances tend, history suggests, to lead to increased cost and increased demand coming into the system, because we're helping people to live longer, which is great, but they end up then with more complex conditions which need to be managed. Hang on,
we're on robots and longer living
and
for the NHS pressures.
They
now,
also do need to be cared for, so the two things do still go hand in hand.
Lady in the second, no, because you're going to mention robots again. Well, the lady in the second.
All I was going to say was that we're talking about now and the next couple of years.
Oh, fine, okay.
What about 5, 10 years' time is what I'm saying. The situation is completely different in 5, 10 years' time.
get to know Alexa. She's a great company.
Lady in the second row there. No robots.
No robots here.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Laura Sorovala, and I'm originally from Finland, lived in Wales for 14 years. Not an economic migrant, so I wanted to make a comment, a potential provocation, and a question. they're trying to keep it light, right? So a comment on that fact that, you know, I'm coming from Finland where it's the utopia of perfect education and great careers, and why did I leave? I came to Britain because the creative industries here are an inspiration. There's a tradition and a massive heritage of why you want to come to Britain to work in the creative industries, whether it's as a designer or whatever your profession is. So that's why I came here. I've never used any benefits. I've been very much about, I want to work hard for myself so I can provide for myself, and I've been able to succeed in that. Just a comment on that. The provocation might be that throughout my time living here, I have noticed overall that people who come into the country are prepared to work a lot harder than the people who are already here. I could see in university, in jobs, and it's a massive, I don't know, maybe it's a cultural difference. It's, I don't know how to unpick that, but I've seen it happen and witnessed it in different places. So the other question that, again, a thing, not about robots, but a thing that hasn't been discussed is, I'm self-employed. So we're not talking about, where's the discussion about startups? People who set up businesses and are using networks as a different way of working culture. We're not all employed, you know, and that culture is changing very rapidly. So that's a whole different scenario to think about, not just people who are employed in a traditional sense.
Okay.
So if you've got any comments on that.
Your thoughts that people that come to the UK tend to be more willing to put in a day's work?
I think that's hard to determine. Certainly the analysis of employers is that actually employers, certainly in some sectors, so there was an analysis recently done by NISA which looked at employers in agriculture, hospitality, some of the key sectors of EU, with EU migrants, and they didn't necessarily say that EU migrants worked harder, they preferred it for that reason, but just because they tended to be more flexible, that was one of the reasons they tended to hire, and you know, so it wasn't necessarily to do with the quality of work, but to do with the flexibility. I'd just say, I think your point about the creative industries is very important, and also other sectors which do rely on lots of self-employment and kind of flexible working, like tech sector, and this is something which, again, any new model of immigration is going to have to think a lot about, because just simply replicating what we currently have and filling EU migrants into that isn't going to work for those industries. It's not going to work for the self-employed. We need to think much more creatively about these particular sectors. So I would emphasise, you know, particularly for small businesses, for startups, they're not going to be able to navigate the current system for tier two migrants, which, for instance, require paying hundreds of pounds for a new immigration skills charge for every migrant that they want to hire. We need to think about this much more creatively in order to foster these particularly important industries.
Finland, and by my mind, therefore, Scandinavia, Norway. We've heard a lot about the Norway model, where you can come into the country and you have 3 months or 6 months where you have to find a job or set up your own business. Do you think that's something that you would find tolerable? I mean, and bearing in mind your view about it shouldn't just be about the economy, it should be about what you can contribute to society.
Yeah.
You've got 6 months to prove your worth.
Not purely on an economic basis.
No.
Yeah. Yes, I would be happy with that. But I'm smiling slightly wryly because everything I've read suggests that the Norway model is not going to be applicable in this case anyway, given the other negotiations with the
Don't
trade
tell
dealers.
Carwin Jones, he's been there, he loves it.
But yeah, if that was to happen, then great.
Alp, what do you think for that?
Norway, Iceland and Liechtenstein are part of what is known as the European Economic Area, as I'm sure everyone here knows all about. The fact is that means being a part of the whole free movement of labour arrangement. That isn't going to happen.
If you can prove that you've got a job or set up your own business.
It's no.
No, but
anyone from Iceland
what if that
or
was the
Norway? Well, then. What I suspect might happen then is that there are a lot of people who are going to come here to work, say they're coming here to set up a business and never leave. and there will be a lot of people who have no intention of setting up a business, simply because that's what normally happens. When there are gaps, there is huge abuse. It will be a total nightmare.
Okay. Anyone else want to come in? In that case, I think there's a gentleman in the back there. Yep.
Hi, my name's Esko, and you're really out of luck. I'm also from Finland. I've started some companies. I employ people here. I'm a migrant like this. And I want to continue on the theme that it feels a little bit like this discussion is fiddling with the aqueducts while Rome is burning. So I'd like to take a little higher level view and say, in case we haven't noticed, there's a big realignment going on globally between people who believe in what have traditionally been called Western values or liberal democratic values, and another camp which doesn't subscribe to the same kind of geopolitical fault lines we've seen before, but it's the authoritarian populists who want to introduce this kind of chauvinist, in some sense it could be democracy, but it's a complete distortion to what we understand from our traditional value set. And you can't just point to that country over there and say it's us versus them. These fault lines are going through our societies at the moment. So what feels to be missing from this conversation is the consideration of the values, and where does Wales want to, on a value basis, locate itself when the chips fall after this whole Brexit? One of the potential scenarios is that continental Europe will descend into war again. And then the refugee situation that you're looking at looks like the southern Mediterranean now, right? It's boats full of people who are escaping a burning continent. Yeah. These are the kind of questions, and I'm really sorry that our man from Whitehall, when there is a suggestion that Wales might be intellectually considering how it might carve its own path, says, don't be ridiculous, you don't have any agency in this matter. You will follow instructions from the central government, and that's the end of the discussion. So I'm sorry, I guess you can tell from my voice, I'm a little bit piqued about this, but there are far bigger questions here, and I think the looking at the details kind of prevents us from considering that bigger picture.
I mean, from that issue of Wales wanting to forge its own path, isn't all the evidence that we've seen so far suggesting, from Theresa May downwards, we'll listen to you, but it's going to be at the UK level where these decisions are made? Does that play into your thinking at all?
The people of Wales haven't decided that. There are boys in eastern Ukraine dying every day for the idea of liberal values, European way of life, right? We don't have any skin in the game in Wales. And I do consider this is my home, like Laura, maybe I'll have to go because my neighbors say that you've taken back control and I don't belong here, right? Dirty foreigners out. Doesn't make me so motivated to continue doing my investments here, kind of thing. But that's a question for the Welsh people or the community of Wales, the wider community of Wales. Do you care enough? The Scottish people are going to give a different answer. The Northern Irish people are going to give a different answer. They're not just going to take what Theresa May interprets as this will of the people, but there's no fire in the belly of Wales yet, and what is this discussion if it's not to find that?
Where's the fire in our belly, Marley?
Well, you make some good points. I don't think it's for me to say, in a way. What I would say is, your point about there being this kind of global dichotomy between liberalism and some form of authoritarianism, or however you want to form it. I think the way to get through that, in my view, in the UK, is to try and find a consensus on the most challenging issues of the day, and that's Brexit and immigration, and that's about trying to think how can we find a system on immigration we're discussing today, but apply in other areas as well. How can we find a system that's capable of winning over the public on a broad level? How can we find public consent for a new immigration system? Because if we don't have public consent, if we don't have backing for a system, then it's not sustainable. That's why we've talked a bit about devolving some of the responsibilities for immigration, because obviously, the result of the referendum meant many things, but obviously the theme of taking back control was paramount in the discussion. And giving the nations and the regions a greater say over how they want their immigration policy to work, we think could both both help that discussion because it gives people a greater say over how they want immigration to work in their area. It can help potentially the discussion, the actual narrative about immigration, because it can make people start to think, well, look, this is actually, you know, my region, my nation. I can think about how immigration's gonna work here. What are the big trade-offs? What are the trade-offs for in terms of skill shortages? What are the trade-offs in terms of pressures on services? I can start to think about it more at a regional and potentially local level. And in that sense, we can start to build a consensus. But I think without a consensus, we're not going to have a sustainable system, whether it goes in one direction or the other.
I want to take one more question from the audience, and then we'll try and make some more headway on that. David,
yeah, then. Thank you very much, David Hughes, head of the European Commission Office in Wales. Just one comment and one question. My comment is just about the Norway model. There seems to be a little bit of a misunderstanding about quite what that is. In fact, legally, the system of free movement that applies in Norway, Directive 2004/38, if you want to know, is basically exactly the same as it is in the rest of the EU. So the legal obligations on Norway are pretty much exactly the same. My question is, I'm looking at the question up on the screen there, which is the debate for this evening. And I confess I've been fiddling on my phone to check various things, so I may have missed it. But I don't think I've heard anyone on the panel address the issue of UK nationals moving to live and work in other member states. And I'm just wondering, you know, bearing in mind that there are certain member states that have a lot more Brits in them than send their nationals here, I'm just wondering whether the panel have any comments on that aspect of that question up on the screen.
Alp, should we start with you?
I was actually going to make that point when we were taken onto a higher plane, that the question for debate tonight is free movement post-Brexit for Wales. What does that mean? You're absolutely right about Brits also working in other EU countries. I would expect that whatever arrangements we have here will apply to British folk working in EU countries. Now, I personally, and I'm pretty sure the government thinks that no one who is here legally at the moment, as I mentioned earlier, 85% either have the right to be here or will acquire that right by the time we leave the EU. That will also allow us to bring in, I hope, the sort of people that we need. And all this is about is stopping free movement in the sense that anyone who wishes to set up in any other bit of the European Union is not going to be able to do that. There will be control over them. That doesn't mean to say it will stop. It will simply mean that you're not free to choose the country that you live in. In exactly the same way that Americans, Canadians, Indians, any other nationality that you care to mention who are not members of the European Union actually find their way to this country and are perfectly happy to live in this country. And no one, I hope that your neighbours aren't saying, the Finnish gentleman who said his neighbours are asking him to leave. I've been a foreigner in this country for a lot longer than you are probably born. I don't know, I'm nearly 70. I came here as a child. I have never, ever experienced what everyone seems to be concerned about, that there is racism in the sense that because of your colour, because of your race, you should leave this country. We are just not that sort of country. Of course, there are individuals who will take that stupid line. I'd like to believe that it's a very, very tiny proportion and that they are stamped upon and should be stamped upon at every opportunity. I'm stamping on them now. You're ghastly, you're awful, we don't want you, you don't think like us, and we are very much the majority.
What about that point, I'll put this to you, Noreen, that David Hughes is making there, that actually, and I think we had it from Joe Hunt from Wales Government Centre at Cardiff University, who was saying a while back, Actually, in the UK at the moment, you can only come for 3 months from the EU. You know, you don't have the right to stay indefinitely. It's just not being implemented. Is that something that you were aware of and
Sorry.
Think that perhaps should have been implemented?
The people from the EU
yeah.
can only come for three
months.
Currently can only come 3 months,
3 months
to the UK.
It's just not being implemented.
I'd never heard
is that,
of it
is
before.
Is that right for all
no.
David? All
no, it's not. It's not right, actually. You can come here. You have 3 months in which to get a job. In theory, in practice, you come in
but
and that's it.
But the rules are 3 months. You say theory. That means it's just not being implemented by the government.
Well, when you look at the numbers coming here, we're talking about millions of people. It's simply totally unrealistic. And then there's the right of appeal, and there's whatever. You try doing it. That's why it doesn't. It's not enforced. It hasn't needed to be. That's the truth.
Vanessa, beyond the NHS, take your NHS out for a moment. At that point, we were saying, what kind of country do we want Wales to be? Do you think there's an opportunity here, I guess, to have that debate and to sort of reshape, I guess, what kind of country we can be?
I think when you look at values and I can't sort of take off the NHS hat. I've got to think about it in that way because I'm here representing our members. And since the referendum, we have seen an increase in the numbers of incidents of intolerance towards EU workers. And that's something that has really challenged our members. A number have come out publicly to support EU workers and to recognise that our values are about respecting the workers that we have and recognising their contribution and their value. And I think there is a wider lesson for the country as a whole in respect of that. And I think one of the things that we want to be able to do is reassure people who work currently here from the EU that they will have absolutely the right to remain, and more than that, that other people will be able to come and take jobs in the NHS in the years to come.
We've got time for one last question. I can see you with your microphone there. If you can keep it brief, because trains are going to leave whether or not we finished or not.
Fred Till, a recent graduate. I wanted to actually end the question at you, Alp, and it seems that your main concern is the numbers, the net migration numbers at the point of the border. And I understand your concerns about the applicability of a regional visa policy, but I wonder whether you think that government could or should play a greater part in planning the labour migration workforce. I wonder whether you think that the government could or should play a greater role in planning labour migration movement between nations and regions within the UK, whether you think that's possible.
Yeah, I'm not sure it is possible for government to have that degree of control within the country in the way that you're suggesting. Why I said that Marley's system of really enforcing where people lived as well as where people worked, it just isn't practical. I don't know. I'd rather have central government have less to do with our lives actually than they do at the moment. So I wouldn't like to see that.
But how will you control immigration and decide who needs what unless they have that element of control?
Because we're doing it now. We're doing it all the time. We have a system of legislation, laws in place that allow you to do that. We have a whole civil service that is devoted to determining who comes here.
Predicated, as Marley was saying, on the freedom of movement from the EU, which makes it a lot easier to fill any voids which may come up. If we're on a totally planned system, that's going to mean a lot more interference from the state, isn't it?
No. As I keep saying, we already have that system in place and it applies to all non-EU nationals.
Which is about half of the total.
It's actually more than half the net migration total. So it is something that we can do. Whether how well we do it is a different question, of course. But one very important point about that was raised at the very outset. One of the questions asked that let's stop all immigration until the economy improves, when the economy is actually performing at the moment better than nearly every other economy in the world. But that, to me, is the crux of the matter, and why so many people voted to leave last June. They are not getting the benefits. We may be doing well, but not all that wealth that is being created is finding its way into those who are in greatest need in many respects. And that is something that I believe, unless the EU itself addresses, then it poses dangers for the whole of the EU longer term. They've got to do that, and there's a lot of people in Brussels who think exactly that. We've got to be serious about reforming the EU, they say. I agree with them.
Last point.
Very last point. I agree that the economic system is more at fault, and that actually if it was providing for the people who are working in it better, A, there would be much less fear-based fear of the other and wanting to restrict immigration because they're taking our jobs and our money, because actually they're not. But I don't think it's the EU responsibility. It's what are we doing as a nation, what are we doing as the UK, but what are we doing as Wales as a devolved nation? How much agency have we got, and how much control have we got and self-determination? And in a slight response to that final question, I'm still not clear what we've achieved here today, because Theresa May has said, okay, yeah, we'll listen to devolved nations, but it doesn't mean they're going to take anything into account. It doesn't mean it's any more than tokenistic. And so unless we decide collectively to mobilize and take action and do something, I'm not saying, you know, I just made myself sound like, you know, build barricades and burn things. But no, if we decide to unite and start moving towards the result that we want according to the values that we believe in, then we can start doing something of worth.
Nice point at which to end the proceedings. So we're totally out of time. The clock's beating us. I know that Professor George Boyne from Cardiff University is going to come up and thank you. Thanks in a moment. But can just for the moment, could we just show your appreciation, please, to the panel?